Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Episode 10 of Chasing the Sun, the epic story of the star that gives us life, of Richard Cohen. We've done many chapters so far. The last extraordinary chapter was of the Chinese, and I suppose the two aspects of the Chinese that you really want to take away with you is that the heavens were not an indication of what was going to happen in the future. They were a judgment of what was happening right now. So it was sort of like this gigantic conceptual police state. It's very interesting to see that. The other aspect is Matteo Ricci, or Mr. Curly. That's what it means in Italian. Mr. Curly, he's a Jesuit who went toe-to-toe with Ming Dynasty eunuchs and won using science. It's an interesting thing. It's something worth reading and reading again. This time it's to do with the Islamic or Muslim custodianship of astronomy. And I've had an interest in Muslims ever since I was actually accused of being a Muslim sympathiser and possible terrorist. This is quite serious. I had my computer confiscated and woke me up. I said, oh, look, these guys are going through an awful lot. Better find out. And the more I investigated, that passed, of course. So the police looked at it and said, this is rubbish. Indeed it was. I don't know if you've heard of too many. I was accused of being a sympathiser to Muslims, but besides not being a potential terrorist threat, and of course this was by people up in the education department, and of course the higher you're up, the less you're able to admit faults or, do anything with that. And so for me, it was a little bit of education, and I began to find, there's three, possibly four Muslim sects, an extinguished sect which was linked to what we would call terrorism, and then the whole complexity of it just didn't translate through, and the people I was speaking with who were in positions of authority really had no idea. They had no idea whatsoever. So I've just said, oh, this is an area to research. And of course this chapter by Richard Cohen is similarly a fantastic chapter coming up. I can say that you will thoroughly enjoy it. I did thoroughly. I read it ahead, and I can say it is the most eye-opening, jaw-dropping chapter to see things explained in sequence and logically structured, and to see different people come in with commentary and a commentary on their commentary to see how pro-Western it is and how it really didn't unpack what was going on. And the fact that dropping the torch, so to speak, of knowledge is something which most civilizations do all the time, and they come back to it. If we can actually claim Greek heritage and knowledge, surely the other cultures can claim Islamic scholarship in their culture as a root, as a fundamental, as equally as any modern day person could. So look, I'll just read this, and it's called Chapter 8, The Sultan's Turret. So I think it will be episode 11, because we've had a preface, a pre-chapter, and two chapters to get through the mighty, one of the last chapters. The Greeks, took me two reads to get through. And that was, again, a fascinating point. The main point about the Greeks is that the most quoted ancient person was pre-medieval, in that he had already got into the idea that there is no new knowledge, I just commentary, I'm just a a Carl Sagan or a, I wish I could think of the other names involved in it. And to see how that went through. Again, it's probably worth rereading to burn into my head. But this is the opening verse of Rabita of Omar Khayyam. Horrible Australian pronunciation. Okay. And this is interesting because the Chinese believe that it was a bowl on top of us on the map of China. It was the heavens. This is an interesting thing here. Awake, for morning is in the bowl of night, has flung as the stone that puts the stars to flight. And lo, the hunter of the east is caught, the sultan's turret in a noose of light. The sun. And this is the next quote from the Quran. There's always two quotes. Quran, thank goodness. I know how to pronounce Quran, because it's spelled Q-U-R apostrophe A-N, Quran. Okay. And when the night overshadowed him, he saw a star and said, "This is my Lord." And when he saw the moon beginning to rise, he said, "This is my Lord." And when he saw the sun begin to rise, he said, "This is my Lord, grace of all." And we'll see how the prophet left coded, non-scientific formula, mechanical formula to work out when to do things, and that left set the Islamic world with a task of understanding astronomy. He's sort of the prophet, basically in his Quran, gave when to pray in code and directions in code, sort of like dead reckoning from the measuring, doing this measurement, that measurement. He gave basically astronomical measurements, which set the course of astronomical scholarship. And back in 1959, the novelist and cultural historian Arthur Koster published The Sleepwalkers, a remarkable account of the scientific discovery throughout history. His summary of the Islamic civilization added to astronomy is harsh. The Arabs, he concludes. Okay, so this is brilliant. He's got a commentator. He comments on the commentary. So it's great. The go-between is preservers and transmitters of the Greek-Indian heritage. They had little scientific originality, creativeness of their own. During the centuries, they were the sole keepers of the treasure. They did little to put it to use. They improved the calendrical astronomy and made excellent planetary tables. They elaborated both Aristotelian and Ptolemaic models of the universe. So Aristotle is this 55 spheres. Ptolemy has got spheres orbiting within spheres. But Ptolemy really is just, I don't know, commentator. They are imported into Europe and the Indian systems of numerals based on the symbol zero, which place value more importantly, and the sine function and use of algebraic methods. So incredibly, they didn't have the Romans didn't have sine functions, but they did not advance theoretical science. The majority of the scholars who wrote in Arabic were not Arabs but Persians, Jews and Nestorians. And by the 15th century, the scientific heritage of Islam had largely been taken over by Portuguese Jews. Okay. Yeah. It is really interesting. So you watch Jews in the background. When I say Jews in the background, it sounds like some racist, but there is a key point of Jewish intervention into this. While its comments are correct in one sense, they do not take into account that during Europe's Dark Ages, any holding operation, if that adequately describes the Islamic contribution, had great value in itself. Okay, the Dark Ages were indeed bloody dark. It's sort of like, if you can imagine going to a dinner party, all the other nations going around, and Europe is having an epileptic fit and splashing baked beans on its face. That's my view of it. Just to retain knowledge and incrementally advance, it was enormously important, not least in solar astronomy. Tellingly, the great Belgian-American scholar George Sutton, 1884 to 1956, divides his magisterial five-volume history of science into half centuries. Okay, so that's 250 years, each of which he associates with one central figure. Okay, that's a nice reading. He begins in 450 BC. Did he say half century? Oh, no, 50 years. I don't understand that one. With Plato, followed by Aristotle, Euclid, Archimedes. Well, that's... okay. But from 750 AD, there were traces, an unbroken line of Arabic and Persian scientists. Shabir al-Kamazai, who worked on calendars, the true position of the sun, spherical astronomy, eclipse calculations, al-Razi, al-Muzadi, Abu Wafa, al-Birini, and Avincia, ending with Omar Khayyam, AD 1050 to 1066. Okay, so 1066 and all that is when the Normans conquested, and they saw Halley's Comet in 1066. So that was in there, and the people were wacko. Remember the Christian religion has the holy star. Okay. Grithiath al-Din Abu al-Fath al-Mur ibn Ibrin al-Nibraso al-Kaimi. Oh my God, look at that. So I'll just tell you, there's one, two... Okay, I'm going to count them as separate words if they're hyphenated. Okay, Al-Din is two words. Three, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten, 11, 12 words. The man of the West calls Omar Khayyam, he's the last person, was largely unknown to the Western world, until 1859. So when does 1859? So this George Sutton is after this. When an effort Suffolk gentleman scholar Edward Fitzgerald published an anonymous translation of the 400,000 lines Rabita, literally quatrains, stanzas in four lines. I like that, quatrains. And so that's what we really write this poem, and you remember that ancient people wrote in poems, so that's an important thing. By the time Fitzgerald was well into middle age, his previous work had aroused little interest. He was probably unsurprised when this too seemed to meet the same fate. 2 years after publication, however, a London bookseller sold off his remaining stock from a penny bargain box outside the shop near Leicester Square. And another poet, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, picked up a copy and was soon declaring the work a masterpiece. By the end of the century, aided by a long-running enthusiasm for Persian culture in the 19th century Britain, it would become the most popular poem of its time. Yet, Rabita turns out to be only one of Khayyam's many accomplishments. Okay, this is a little bit similar to me. I pick up books from fates and stuff like that, and I read them and get enthusiastic, and people say, oh, it's not mainstream, oh, it's if it is Wikipedia, it's stupid, if it's not Wikipedia, it's not in Wikipedia, you know, it's just amazing. But yeah, there's a similar story for me reading, and look, this is a similar book, this is a book sold cheaply by a Canberra publisher who picks up volumes of books that can't sell elsewhere. He picks them up cheaply. Isn't that amazing? Khayyam lived in Nashapur, now northeastern Iran, close to the Afghan-Turkestan borders. His last name means tempt maker. And in one of his verses, he writes pellingly of Khayyam, who stitched the tents of knowledge, which is precisely what he did. He was the author of the well-received treatise on the demonstration of problems of algebra, and was the first to come up with a general theory of cubic equations, which is really interesting because you've got the Quantum Astrologer book. Again, these books you read, and unfortunately with my sieve brain, they're just in memory, but they're not fully in memory. G'day, mate. Starting up the podcast again, you've heard podcast interrupted by my friend Pino coming around, and I've been showing him some of the stuff that I've been doing, and he's able to help me out because I can't handle anything sharp because it will cut me, or it has cut me, and sort of bleed for 12 hours. But whereas you would clean up a cut in or 5-10 minutes, it takes a good 24 hours. Yeah, it would have been about 12 hours and was still just you know, bleeding ever so slightly. So he's come across and helped me cut bits of plastic that I need to do to make some of the experiments that I'm working on. Okay, we're in reading Chasing the Sun, and we have just discovered that a whole line of Arabic logic was translated, disregarded at the time, and then rediscovered. And similarly, this is a similar situation. This book is really in the penny box at the moment, and I've picked it up and read it, and it's full of information. So there's sort of layers upon layers. It's almost like finding gems in landfill, so to speak. So he's found about this person who had this huge, absolutely long name. I can't remember where he's... Oh, yes. This person, and his name's Tent Maker, and I think it stopped about how he said he stitched the tents of knowledge, which is precisely what he did. He was the author of the well-received treatise on demonstrations of problems of algebra, and was the first to come up with the general theory of cubic equations. He also helped perform the Persian calendar, basing it on the solar year, not the lunar, the result, according to Gibbon, being a computation of time which surpasses the Julian and approaches the accuracy of the Georgian style. He measured the solar years to be 64.242198581156 days, which is an extraordinarily accurate computation given the end of the 19th century was measured to be 365.242196. Okay, so he's off there. It's now refined to rather than a 6, a 0 in the last digit. And of course, what it is actually, the Earth is slowing down. As the Moon is moving out, it's slowing down. He constructed a star, and of course, that's 6 decimal places in. That's a millionth of a second, a microsecond, a few microseconds. Okay, and it sort of speeds up and slows down as the weather changes, the poles melt, the water goes to the outside, and the moment of inertia slows the rotation down. Khayyam and his 7 fellow scientists at the Sarin group, Sarin's group of choice, but they were abetted by many others. So he's Sarin is the scholar. He's picked it, but there's many more, he says. Faced with Kostel's dismissal, this is the person, another person who said, look, they added nothing. One might ask, what made Arab science, in particular its mathematicians and astronomers, so outstanding for more than 350 years? And what is a fair estimate of Islam's contribution to solar astronomy? These two questions take up the first half of this chapter. It turns out that the answer to one is totally bound up with that of the answer, because Islam valued knowledge not only for its own sake, but also, in the case of astronomy, a specific study of the sun for its contribution to religious observance. Okay, so essentially the prophet gave Islam solar riddles they had to solve, so they had to be astronomers to work it out. Thereafter we will look at how around 750 AD through to the coming of Copernicus, the study of the sun was evolving in other cultures, mostly notably India, and then back in Europe. It started in AD 630 with the Prophet Muhammad bin Abdullah bin Abdulmuttalib, marched on his birthplace, Mecca. So he's got the full name of it, so it's quite amazing. I don't know what bin means. The city surrendered without a fight and became a centre of philosophical pilgrimage for Muhammad's new religion of Islam. Now, Muhammad got exiled from Mecca, okay, and went in his exile is the start of the
is this the start of year zero, not as a birth or death, anything like that. Or I don't think I don't know whether we believe he died. I think the Islamic people believe he ascended into heaven on a cloud from the rock. It's pretty amazing. So in the moment of his next victory over the Jewish settlement of Kaaba, he and some of his men were given a dinner by a local woman who spiked their meat with poison. He took over 2 years to die, finally succumbing 8 days short of his 63rd birthday. Well, I don't know whether the Muslim or Islamic people believe he died. I think they believe he went up to heaven on the rock, and this is why the rock is so important. I just find it really hard to understand. By then he had already established Islam as a social and political force on par with Judaism and Christianity. Within a few decades of his successor, we unite Iran, Iraq, Egypt, taking Alexandria and burning what remained of the Great Library, Syria, Palestine, Armenia. And perhaps, thinking back, probably burning the library is probably the best thing he could have done. North Africa. By AD 750, the rest of North Africa had followed, along with the entire Iberian Peninsula, which is Spain, and much of central and large stretches of South Asia. Okay, so he was going into South Asia. It's pretty amazing. In the 10th century, Islam moved even deeper into Africa, as well as spreading across what had been mainly Hindu principalities of the Indus, in which is now Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh, and then outwards as far as the frontier provinces of China, obviously not forgetting Indonesia. And even the Philippines, how are you about that? The Muslim theocrats could not have been more unlike their Christian or Chinese counterparts in that they tended towards tolerance. And so, during its golden age, Islam was eager to embrace learning of all kinds, its scholars regularly exchanging ideas with astronomers and natural historians from other countries. During the years AD 661 to 751, the caliphs, now there's a ruling Damascus strove systematically to increase their store of knowledge. Now, caliph, there's a footnote for this. Caliph comes from the Arabic Khalifa, meaning vice-regent or successor, specifically successor of Muhammad. It also defines what a person's role should be, to govern according to the Quran and practice in the Prophet. It is a word seldom used for anything other than a leader of the entire Sunni community. The reason for such passion of learning lay in the Muslims' holy book. More than a fifth of the Quran, over 1,100 verses. In fact, I could possibly read the Quran that much. I don't know, it would just blow my head out. He's concerned with the natural phenomenon. Okay. Here's a footnote. A nice echo of the Quran's place in things appears in Sa'adi Smith's first novel, White Teeth, when the twins Millat and Mingrid Jones meet in the university lecture room. Millat arranges the chairs to demonstrate the vision of the solar system, which is so clearly and remarkably described in the Quran centuries before Western science. What it is. Along with the teaching of Muhammad, the Quran forms a great motivating force both for individuals and states to concentrate their energies on such subjects as mathematics and astronomy. As Islamic scholar M.A.R. Khan has noted, quote, "Some of the most eloquent passages of the Quran refer to the grandeur of the stellar world, the regularity of solar and lunar movements among the constellations, the phases of the moon, and the dazzling brilliance of the restless planets. No wonder the Arabs and later converts to Islam from other nationalities and civilizations took to astronomy so enthusiastically and left their permanent mark on it." End of quote. The successors of the caliphs of Damascus, known as Abbasid dynasty, became to power in 751 and ruled for more than five centuries. My godfather, choosing Baghdad over Damascus for their capital and dedicating themselves to building scientific achievements, the first caliphs. So it would be like the presidential, the presidents have to leave libraries. Now, I think Kennedy left a library and then everyone had to leave big libraries as their things. Or airports, you had to do something more and more. Some 12 years before they moved to Baghdad, they began to reconstruct that city, working from a design created by a philosopher and astronomer. Within 50 years of its planning, the new metropolis became the preeminent cultural and scientific center of the world. So, I was trying to think, there's an Australian city which is always going to be, not Canberra, but the multifunctional polis. We're going to build one. At the time when the church forbade the practice of intrusive surgeries, Arabs were giving anesthetics and performing complex operations. I don't know whether you'd survive any of the operations, but there you go. Mathematics exploded. Oh, well. They introduced tangent geometry, posed and solved cubic equations, conducted extensive studies of cones, replaced chords with signs, and laid down the basic theories of the solution of trilineal figures, a rarefied area of higher mathematics. They brought the world's first international banking system, and they also the pendulum and the windmill. Well, there you go, then that's interesting, where the pendulum came from, whether it's, we would tend to look at the investigation of the pendulum very much as Galileo's work. Astronomy flourished along with the rest of the sciences. While the centre of observational astronomy was Baghdad, the Renaissance went far beyond that city, thriving in Muslim capitals of Spain and Central Asia. The caliphs, particularly Al-Masir, who ruled from AD 754 to 775, were great patrons. If you imagine, Europe was just a whole heap of mud-slinging mud huts at this stage. In a typical example, a scientist from India arrived at the court bearing a copy of the Sarid Siddhana, the solar principles written in Hindu astronomy, Abharata, 400 years before. The caliph had it read it in Arabic. Muslims were familiar with Indian and Persian writings sometime before they read the great Greek text. The caliphate of Al-Muhammad, 813-833, was even more progressive. He himself an astronomer. So there you go, the actual king is an astronomer as opposed to the eunuchs, the Ming eunuchs. He founded a celebrated academy, the House of Wisdom, and paid his savants famously well. One senior librarian, on his retirement, was given gold equal to the weight of all the books he had translated. One of Sutton's eight Al-Khazami belongs to this period, as does Al-Kindi, whose massive work, Optics, will become the basis of many of Newton's theories. Now, this is interesting. Newton sort of is just famously bad at citing his sources. He just rambles on with experiments. It's not a Principalia. It's interesting, but it's a bit of a badly written student thing. I mounted this on string. You know how long I pushed the box with things in it, and this is the conclusion I was going for anyway. It's just really badly written. It was Al-Mahmud who introduced the best Greek works of astronomy to his people. Ptolemy Almagus was translated at least five times in the late 8th and early 9th century, once into Syriac and four times into Arabic. He built two observatories, one in the desert outside Rehab and the other at Qassani, west of Damascus. Over the next seven centuries, a dozen observatories would be set up at royal expense, and many more were financed by astronomers themselves. Now, that's interesting, because astronomers would be rich people. So it's an amazing thought to think that Islam, by actually the way it was placed, it's the solar stuff, sort of grafted it fully in. It wasn't in the background, it was fully in. Much of this research was sun-related, calculating the rates of precession and the length of the tropical year, advancing the reason as for why the sun appears larger near the horizon than the zenith. I think zenith is actually an Arab word, if I can remember correctly. Their work was so specifically bound up with Islam. It was also specifically bound up with Islam. Muslims seek to pray facing Mecca, a mountain set city about 50 miles inland from the Red Sea. It is It's not only Muhammad's birthplace, it's also revered as part of the earth's, first part of the earth to be created, where Abraham, and his son Ismaili built the Kaaba cube that Muhammad was to adopt as the focus of all Islamic worship, a physical revelation of the presence of God, which is intended by Muhammad's tribe, the Quraishi. So this is the central rock in Mecca, is that? I think that, I didn't know it was a cube. Built Kaaba. Cube, oh my god. It's K-A-A-B and it's cube. That's amazing. I have to look at it. I think when they go around the rock, it is actually a cube-shaped rock. Such ritual acts as the call to prayer or the halal method of slaughtering animals for food must also be performed facing the Kaaba, the cube. Kaaba. What? But the body remains oriented towards the Kaaba. And Muslim graves and tombs were also laid out with the body lies on its side facing the holy wall. Modern burial practices differ slightly, but the body remains oriented towards the Kaaba. Since Muslims direct their prayers and acts of devotion towards Mecca, they need to know exactly where the Kaaba lies. The cube. Oh no. They have a central cube. Oh, gee, that's incredibly interesting. How do worshippers spread across the vast part of the globe determine the Quilba, the direction they must adopt to face towards the holy city? The Kaaba is actually a pre-Islamic pagan shrine of uncertain origin and date, standing about 50 feet high and 35 feet wide at the center of the court of the great mosque at Al-Haram. Embedded in the walls is a large black stone held by scientists to be a meteorite that all pilgrims are expected to kiss. What? A pagan cube. Oh my god, Father. This is amazing. I just really didn't understand any of this. In the beginning, the faithful used the rising and setting of the sun and positions of fixed stars, the earliest mosques face Mecca, only roughly. Out of desire to be more faithful precision, the Caliph Al-Ma'mun commissioned a team of scholars to establish the coordinates of Mecca and Baghdad. Similarly inspired, the mathematician Al-Biruni wrote a treatise on mathematical geography, Tahid, expressly for the purpose of determining Qibla for Qahans, a walled city along the route between Kabul and Kandahar. During the 9th century, according to the distinguished Arab arabist David King, quote, different schemes of sacred geography were developed, in which the world was divided into sectors about a Kaaba, I don't know what it is, and the Qibla in each sector was defined in terms of the rising and setting of the sun at certain fixed stars. Muslim mathematicians combine tables, especially the Quilba, as an angle to the meridian of each degree of the different terrestrial latitude and longitude using geometric and geometrical solutions. The extremely complex calculations involved led to production of astronomical tables and made it possible for believers, wherever they might be, to know precisely which way to face. By the beginning of the 10th Christian century, mosques were being aligned towards Mecca with a much greater precision and accuracy. Those in Egypt and Andalusia, west of the City of God, faced the sun as it sets at the midwinter equinox, while mosques in the east, Iran, Iraq, and Asia, faced the rising sun. Okay. It's not just a question of a direction to pray, but when. Muslims required accurate knowledge of the sun and moons so they could determine the exact hours of a prayer. According to the 20th century historian of scientists Muhammad Ilbas, quote, so important was the role that only the major astronomers were assigned to principal mosques in different parts of the Muslim world during the medieval periods. The Quran does not specify particular times for prayer. Rather, the faithful are encouraged to use the passage of the sun for guidance. In the early years of Islam, the times were set by simply observing the shadow lengths of the day at twilight, by day, and twilight phenomena in the evening and early morning. Muslims begin their day at sunset, Maghrib, moving onto their second prayer, Isha, when night falls. So when sunset is down and then goes into dark. So it's I'm just trying to think of the there's a belt that is the yeah, I've forgotten the name of the word. This is sunrise, sunset. An astronomical term. It's really gone from my head. I just, I just really can't think of its name. It's half sun, half dark. It's a belt around a planet, any planet. Okay, let's see if I can remember it. Okay. So they at when sunset and when the night comes, that's two prayers. And at Sahur noon to commence shortly after the sun actually crosses the meridian. The last comes Asir, a afternoon prayer which begins when the shadow of any object has gone beyond its midday minimum by an amount equal to its own length. In some Muslim communities, a sixth prayer is added, the Duha, which begins the same time before the midday as the Ashir star begins after it. So you actually have 3 and 5 where people have actually moved the two groups of prayer together. While some early mosques were built without consulting an astronomer, young scholars were encouraged to study astronomy. And mathematics, not just to prepare a calendar. The Islamic version is strictly lunar. That's why Ramadan changes all the time. But also the crucial aid to religious practice. That the long line of great medieval scientists from Muslim worlds coincided with the development of the dynamic, persistent Islamic liturgy is no accident. That's pretty amazing. The introduction of the plain astrolabe, which is just a disc with stars marked on it, the Greek for star tracker. So astrolabe means star tracker. So it's a cube, star tracker, and I just have to just remember what the name of that light dark region of the sun's called. Possibly, it just really hurts my head to really think of it. Possibly as early as the 8th century by Islamic mathematician and astronomer Muhammad al-Fazi, who died in 769 and 806, only increased the Arab interest in studying the heavens, particularly such spectacular manifestations as comets and eclipses. A highly versatile instrument, the astrolabe could measure the altitude and answer so many of the key questions about spherical astronomy that European scholars dubbed the king of instruments. So I really wonder what an astrolabe looks like. The best craftsmen were specifically named astrolabi, makers of astrolabes, star trackers. Such was the demand for the product, but such devices were fashioned in the royal workshops. To make a decorated one's own instrument was a significant achievement. When compared with the Greek speculative approach, the use of these instruments, astrolabes, meridian, quadrant, arbitrary spheres, and celestial globes, transformed the practice of astronomy, providing the foundation on which scientists would build the equipment of laboratories of today. That is true. In 992, the obliquity of the eclipse was measured with a quadrant whose radius was 40 cubits, about 58 feet. The great observatory at Samarkand, a Jainic meridian arc, the radius of over 120.
These magnitudes alone gave Arabian astronomers considerable advantages in accuracy. That would be their greatest contribution to our understanding of the sun. Hello, back again after another break. Well, I had to go off. We're moving the guinea pigs out of the house, which requires a little cleaning for where they've been. Of course, when it gets above 40 degrees, we can't keep the guinea pigs outside. So in they go, into the back bathroom. I have to clean it up. I've taken the time to research some of these things. I find so hard to believe I've read so far. Now, what's the name of the astrolabe? I've forgotten what the star... Oh, what was it? Star Tracker. I love the astrolabe. But, the more seriously zany things, like the cube in Mecca. True. That is true. It's a Kappa. K-A-A-B-A. Kappa. It is a cube. Inside it is indeed the rock, which is a meteorite, which fell down pre-Islamic, was it worshipped anciently, and to add a bit more interest to it, Muhammad added the additional information was that this is the rock which God threw down to earth to tell Adam and Eve where to build their altar. You can imagine. It's a bit confusing all in all. You can imagine Adam and Eve, no stone tools, how that all happens, but it's come across. And indeed, it is in actual fact true that the prophet was poisoned by a lamb roast. That's just a lamb shoulder roast, shoulder of lamb roast. It's a very, very interesting story to find out. So the great thing about this is that a lot of the knowledge about the Islamic writings would have been lost, and it had actually fallen outside the academic system into a penny box and picked up and resurrected here, similar to this, the writings on platypuses and things like that, falling outside of the academic system but coming back. It's a sort of general principle that people have a very simple view, a very run-of-the-mill view of being content with their ignorance by actually containing knowledge in a university. So it's just in the university. Therefore, I can live my life of ignorance. It's almost if I find any knowledge, I can't work it out. I'll put it in a universe, give it to professionals. But it's that amateur stuff which is really bringing forward and bringing this really forward. And when you come to think of it, astrology is really amateur astronomy. I think that might be the thing. But we'll go on to it. Now we'll continue reading this. By the 13th century, the Abbasid Caliphate, harried by Mongol invaders, was in disarray. East and west broke into semi-independent states. In 1220, Genghis Khan, head of some 200,000 horsemen, swept across Central Asia, Afghanistan, overwhelming Samarkand, Baraka, and Bahala, and pressing into eastern Turkey. Genghis died at the age of 72, by then having converted to Islam and changed his passion from destruction to building, but not before he had managed to erase, in the space of 20 years, one of the world's most advanced civilizations. There you go, isn't that amazing? Genghis Khan, of course. This is essentially, he's Mongol, from Mongolia, which is northern China, so he's basically Chinese. Meanwhile, the Crusaders were again wreaking havoc in the western frontiers of the Caliphate. So you've got the Crusaders, the Crusades, and then you've got the Mongols at one thing, and then there's that famous thing where the Crusaders met the Mongols and were absolutely decimated. It's an amazing read. The death blow came in 1258 when the Mongol prince
Kublai Khan, Genghis' grandson, sacked Badghis, destroying its palaces and built public buildings. The libraries and collections of fine art that generations of Khalists had so assiduously assembled were pillaged and burned. Some believe that only one book in every 1,000 survived, which is sort of rather interesting about the internet is making us, you know, less... It's sort of the opposite thing. Information is being diluted as people are just sending heaps of selfies into this database. Arab astronomy, however, would live on. 3 years before he sacked Baghdad, Halagu had succeeded in taking a vital mountain stronghold of the assassins. There's a footnote here. These were particularly terrifying and bloodthirsty religious sects founded in 1090, violently opposed to Abbasid Caliphate, which is the major caliphate. Amin Maalouf, in his History of the Assassin, writes, quote, "The serenity in which the members of the sect accepted their own death led their contemporaries to believe they were drugged with hashish, which is why they were called the Hashishin, or Hashishin, a word of distorted into assassin, and soon incorporated into many languages as a common noun." There you go. Among the prisoners was an astronomer, Nasir al-Din al-Tusi, who had been held as an honoured astrological advisor to the assassin's grand master. Al-Tusi now transferred his allegiance to Hasagu, which is, look, I'm a bit confused. This is the Mongols, the Mongol grandson. And in 1256, a huge observatory was begun under his direction at Mahagra in south of Tabriz, and continued to function for over 80 years, becoming one of the most important of its time. Al-Tusi's criticism of Ptolemy theory, planetary motion, would anticipate Copernican revolution. The Mamluk sultans ruled Egypt and Syria from the mid 1200s to the early 1500s, okay, right up to the Renaissance. Moving towards Turkey, westwards to north West Africa and southern Spain and eastward into India, they effected a Renaissance. Oh, there you go. Of sorts. New centres of learning grew up around the great observatories of Agra and Samarkand, the latter built under the patronage of Alag Beg. Now, I had various students called Beg, so now that means Lord, doesn't it? 1393 to 1440. Now, I've just remembered that I have to remember that band between night and day. It's something rather... Wow. The word really gets me. A grandson of King Tamur the Lame, Malthus Tamburlaine, Aglabeg, great prince, devoted himself to astronomy and compiled style tables so precise that for generations of Arabic astronomers they superseded even Ptolemy's. But the resurgence was transient. The only part of Samarkand's observatory that still survives is a giant underground marble sextant. That's incredible. Various revivals were attempted in the years that followed, but none lasted long. Alag Beg was assassinated in 1440. Science in the Muslim world would then withered away. But for 350 years, the Muslims had put astronomy to work in the service of Islam, and so doing kept it alive. That is a beautiful, beautiful way of saying it. That they put astronomy to the service of Islam. That's what they were interested in. It's pretty interesting. In 1068, a scholar of the time picked out a group of eight nations according to their perceived and contribution to science. So this is a long time ago. This is 2 years, 1066, so it's 1068. the Hindus, Indians, the Persians, Chaldeans, whoever they are, the Hebrews, Greeks, Romans, the Egyptians, the scientists at Alexandria, and the Arabs. The list is simplification, ignoring the many interactions among them. It gives no credit to China, which, well, how would he know? He's got no way of getting to China, which, although it would have been, it may have been a world to itself, should not have been discounted. The Imperial Road is an unexpected and perhaps unwarranted conclusion. Yeah, Romans were really the, I suppose, not the Hitlers, I'd say the Donald Trumps of the time. They will make the empire great again, they'd say. But the list will shape the rest of this chapter, which looks at what the Hindus saw. Isn't that beautiful? Here's a list, but we'll go through it anyway. The Hindu scientists gave solid astronomy and assesses how Western Europe fared in the years before Copernicus. The Vedic religion, the precursor to modern Hinduism, is one of the earliest to have its beliefs and rituals set down in written form. Sanskrit and the Vedas as a whole, the earliest which date back to 1500 BC, are filled with hymns praising the sun as a source sustainer of earthly life, and one which is associated with texts. The Josita Vedanga refers to the sun, Asurya Aditya. So I've taught a few Adityas students, it's a girl's name, Aditya, as the storehouse of inexhaustible power and radiance. Star, there's a footnote here. The word for bright in Yashad, it is citrus, which seems reasonable to suppose that the fruits we now know as citrus, such as oranges and lemons, gained their generic name from their sun-like colour. And when the strife goddess Eris set out to precipitate the Trojan War, she cast down not an apple, but an orange, which was the Greek chrysolma, golden apple. Wow, so an orange is a golden apple, there you go, and then that's a pretty amazing set of information. The first Indian study devoted to astronomy, the Vedas, were already an influential work in the 4th century BC. Perhaps as a result of the early interest, the influence of Italian science was, Indian science was pervasive. And not only in China, where Indian astronomy made inroads within a century or so of the Vedas being written. That great authority on early science, Otto Naumburger, I remember him writing, I can't remember what he wrote, oh gee, my brain's a sieve, writes that Indian astronomy constitutes, quote, one of the most important missing links between late Babylonian astronomy and a fully developed stage of Greek astronomy represented by the Almagest, which is their stuff written by, Ptolemy, which is Ptolemy was, again, he was in the Las Vegas of Egypt, who's a Greek-Egyptian. Las Vegas, I've forgotten the name of this place, there you go. Gee, my head hurts, I can't remember these facts. It is possible that the Indian astronomers exchanged ideas with the Greek and Babylonian counterparts, at least from the time of Ptolemy. So that's late, that's 300 AD, if not well before. Well, the key concepts already represented in the rigid Vedic texts turned up in the Babylonian assembly astronomy in 700 BC. We do know that Indian astronomy was a felt presence in China along with Buddhism during the Tang Dynasty, AD 618 to 9. 07, when many of the sky watchers took up residence in the Chinese capital. By AD, it's 618 to 7907, so that's a good 300 years of whatever it is. By AD 718, Indian astrology had also taken root. While the Chinese adopted the Indian calendar, organized around 28 lunar mansions, next to be, influences Persia, whose Abbasid caliphs were so enraptured by Indian science that they worked to spread its methods into Central Asia. From the 5th century AD, Janus doctrine, which emphasizes the rebirth and reincarnation, but also on supernatural forces issuing as karmas. Okay, here's a footnote for Jainism. Jainism, or Jain Dharma, began in the 6th century BC as a revolt against Hinduism. Revolt, I suppose. It regards every living soul, even those of animals and insects, as potentially divine and advocates non-violence. Unusual in being an atheistic religion, so it's a religion with no God, so I'll have to look that up. God. My brain's really hurting. Okay. It teaches, among other things, that one should not eat, drink, or travel after sunset. Currently, there are 5.2 million Jainists in India, found in all but one of the country's 35 states. Okay, well, you would assume that from that, just logically, that 52 million is not just in one state, but they're moving about, or they're broken up into bits. The Jainist doctrine began to assert itself through most areas of India. A decree, Mount Sumeru, supposedly situated in the Himalayas, to be Earth's centre, around which it revolved the sun, moon and stars. By day, the sun was thought to travel south of the mountains, while at night it hid from view. Jainists had no notion of daylight in one hemisphere and night in another, but imagined each to have its own sun. Gee whiz, obviously it's got to really move up, doesn't it? The Indian picture of the cosmos derived primarily from religious doctrines, and none of the ancient records of the sun or of sunspots or eclipses has been found. Instead, Indian astronomers took the statistics compiled by Babylonian and Egypt and adapted them to their own needs. Calendar computation, timekeeping, the casting of horoscopes. That's interesting. I know that the Hindus are very strongly in horoscopes and magic numbers. I had a Indian employee, and she was obsessed. She wouldn't actually put out certain invoices because that invoice number was unlucky. So we'd go through, and the auditors would be coming along and saying, "Where are these? What's number 13 list? Why is this number?" Some of them would be about 5 digits long, and that would be an unlucky number. I don't know whether she was just kidding, I suppose, but the great thing was that we're in a heritage building, and at the end, when it was all been shut down, I removed the filing cabinet from where she's working. So shows you how old it was. They wouldn't have filing cabinets nowadays. Removed from where she was working, and she removed it, and there was a huge number 13 written on the column. I just laugh. Okay, let's see how we're going. Yet it was the Indians who reckoned the age of the Earth as 4.3 billion years. Even in the 19th century, as many scientists were convinced, it's almost at most 100,000 years old. The current estimate being 4.6 billion. Again, they had this various eons and ages. The Indian civilization, this is not the Big Bang. It is interesting that the Sikh religion has, in fact, a Big Bang. I was teaching the Big Bang, and the Sikh kids have their little silver bands around their arms. So when they steal, they look at the silver band and say, "Oh, I better not do it, I'm Sikh." But they said, "Well, what you just described is banging on what we are taught in our religion classes." Okay. Indian civilization most influenced Western astronomy, not through its theories, but through its development of mathematical tools. Brilliantly innovative spherical trigonometry, for instance, and the invention of the decimal place. It's not so much a decimal place, it's place of value, which is the concept of zero functioning as a number. I don't think they introduced decimals. No, there was no decimal, wasn't them. They still had the Babylonian, I read the serial numbers. They had place values different from decimal place. This is going tenths to hundredths and so forth downwards. Okay, let's continue reading
This is a huge footnote here, so I hope that I can pick it up. The fall of Rome extinguished the essentially bilingual civilization of the West, resulting in a most total disappearance of Greek language outside the Eastern Empire, with most major works in Greek science meeting the same fate. This is important, that Greek lived on because it was a bilingual place, but then with Greek science it's disappeared. Astronomy moved philosophically from a pagan to a Christian milieu. That's interesting. And geographically, from one intellectual centre in Alexandria to another in Constantinople. But between 300 and 700 years after Ptolemy and his discipline, both observation theoretical was almost entirely neglected. The vicissitudes of war, faith, and faith subjected learning to long hiatuses, disastrously for highly technical science dependent on competent, consistent instruction handed down from one generation to the next. Isn't that beautifully written? Is this David Cohen person? You are a genius. The way that you write, you are on fire, page after page, mate. In 398, the Christian mob broke the library of, I remember the Alexander, I don't remember the museum, but the Christians just were just yucks. There's an asterisk for the Alexandria Museum, let's read, of course. Of course, solar astronomy was also practiced outside the main cultures we have examined, but either a basic kind or not essentially differing from that of the countries we have looked at. The main contributions of South American and Mexican astronomy were discussed in chapter 20, are discussed in chapter 20. Otherwise, one may take as a typical custom, at least up to the early years of the 20th century, of the New Zealand's Maori, where the elite drawn from the Tohunga. Now, this is if you've read Bionicles. Bionicles, if you hear people speaking Bionicle, they're speaking Maori, because they've just, Lego has just taken the Maori language and put it into their Bionicles. Okay, with Toa. Or the Adept class would spend hours each night contemplating the Rariki, or the little suns of stars, and were relied on as weather forecasters. Travellers and fishermen consulted them before their journey, and the power of the Toghung Korangi stretched to the foretelling general aspects of future seasons, their fruitfulness or otherwise. Such men were valuable observers, but their contribution to solar astronomy itself was minimal. So it's an interesting story to really get into. In 415, another mob lynched the leading astronomer, Lady Hapitha. So this is, she was a pagan, Hapitha. So it's interesting that the pagans were still about the place, and the lynching story is a stomach-turning story of just misogynistic, born-again Christians. Oh, God. Any writings from 650 to 300 were negligible, partly the effect of iconoclastic persecutions of the 8th century. Yeah, you had the ripping up of any icons in history. It was sort of like Islamic State all over. Throughout much of the old world, most people were living in the absolute margin. Their lives threatened by barbarian invasions, calls to war, and ever more frequent migrations, famine, plagues, floods, and other disasters, which is absolute true. And of course, you read the Birth of Islam, and you see invading. That's what everyone was doing. That was the murder operation, as the business model was just invade everybody. The kids loved it. Kids love reading this type of stuff. It's their children's book. Now you read Ranger's Apprentice, and it's full of this world where people are, they're just basically, you know, the parents were away and they were just having a good old box up, fight up. In 526, Antioch was, so there was wrecked by an earthquake, so there were five centres set up by, equal centres set up by, was it Justinian? Yeah, he's out five centers, which were Constantinople, which is, yeah, Constantinople, Antioch, Rome, Alexandria, and there was another. Was it Damascus? He set up five centers of the church. So the church was sort of distributed, and, you know, it's just a very interesting aspect of it. The Roman church only separated when Constantinople church couldn't send supplies to stop the people wrecking it. It's interesting. I love reading that type of stuff. In 526, Antioch was wrecked by an earthquake. In 42, Constantinople was scourged by bubonic plague. 9 years later, an earthquake and tsunami killed tens of thousands of people in Lebanon. This is sort of like, it's Will Conan the Barbarian time, this thing. The year 856 saw a major earthquake in Greece. In 1069, a famine in Egypt. I think there was even famines in Europe. The 10th century alone brought 20 severe famines, some lasting 2 to 3 years. Well, it's every year was a famine. The 11th century is no better. France endured at least 26 famines. England, a famine every 14 years or so. Earthquakes. So you've got to understand this is why you had suddenly these large people moving about, which could be formed into armies. Earthquakes in 1138, 1262, and 1290 killed upwards of 500,000. In 1228, a great flood swept away 100,000 people and a substantial portion of the Low Countries. Yeah, this is a really interesting. So they had wild weather events in the Dark Ages. Then, in the middle of the 14th century, a bubonic plague returned in the form of the Black Death, raging for 6 years, killing off well over a third of the people in Europe, as well as multitudes in Asia and North Africa, probably 25 million in all. It was achievement enough to survive, let alone map the heavens.
It's a nice talk. Where's that red one?
Yeah, it's sort of very interesting. I'm a little bit disturbed here as my guests, the young guests visiting and going out for a walk. Okay, but as I see, this is not too many pages to finish this off. No, it's a few more pages. At the end of the 9th century, the West was just beginning to emerge from its dark ages. Okay, so you've got political instability, no clear church. It's, you know, warlords and disasters and plagues. And it's interesting to know that the Black Death was a more virulent form of the bubonic plague. So, Arab astronomers had streamed into Spain, and by the 10th century, Cordoba, which had boasted 500,000 inhabitants, several libraries, a medical school, and a large paper trade, was a substantial centre of learning. So which time was that one? 10th century, they had paper by that time. Oh yeah, okay, Middle Ages. While trade routes between West and the Arab world were by this time long established, the exchange of scientific knowledge began only when Christian scholars visited Spain in the 11th century. Not only imbibing Arab ideas, but also reclaiming their own heritage as a result. By the 12th century, Toledo, which I visited there, Toledo is actually quite a boring place, in actual fact. They've got the big museum and big buildings there. It just hasn't got much going for it, in my opinion. By the 12th century, Toledo was the hub of translating Arab into Latin, Hebrew, and Castilian, as well as many other languages. The Almagest was rendered by an anonymous Sicilian into Latin in 1160. Although it remained a difficult work, some words were not understood but simply transliterated, such as Nadir, or zenith, which is the result of the number of simplified, often inaccurate versions appear. Like a game of Chinese whispers, each translation became progressively more removed from the original. Now, what's it, a word misappropriated? There's folk entomology, word science, but there's also mistranslations, like the word syllabus was a miswritten word in a manuscript. It was a misspelling. You've got these mutation words. The greatest scientists' influence endures in the early months. So this was the greatest scientist would be Aristotle. It's what we call, I think so. In the early months of 2008, a New York couple sent their young son to a small nursery school in Brooklyn. Seven of his fellow pupils were named Ptolemy. Okay, so he's the greatest. I wouldn't call him the greatest scientist. Even so, in 1200, thanks to Arab translation at Cordoba and Toledo, recently accurate Latin versions of Ptolemy and the main works of Aristotle, Plato, Euclid, Archimedes, and Galen were circulating. Ptolemy's writings became almost synonymous with astronomy and were really questions, although the leading Arab astronomers certainly had their doubts, discerning yet more errors in his system, particularly in his theories of planetary motions. How to explain, for example, the great variation in brightness of Mercury and Venus by the readings. So, just to give you a view, that Venus is full brightness at the furthest point, the full moon furthest away, half, and it's actually a new moon closer to us, so it's a huge... So Venus itself, it's like a reflected light at a huge distance, so it's quite a complicated thing. I think that Galileo spent a lot of time looking at Venus. It's also interesting that Galileo went blind at the end. How to explain? The greatest of a new generation of Arab scientists, Ibn Rushd, 1126-98, known as Averroes, whose massive commentaries on Aristotle earned him the name the Sobriquet the Commentator, wrote, I do remember him reading bits. The astronomical sciences of our days offer nothing from which one can derive an existing reality. The models that had been developed in our times accords with computations, not with the way things actually are. Isn't that beautiful? It's a beautiful saying. King Alfonso X of Castile, 1221-84, is said to have remarked on being introduced to the Ptolemaic Valley that had he, Alfonso, been present at creation, he might have given the Almighty some better advice. Is that beautiful? Yeah, the Ptolemaic thing is that you have rotation about epicenters, but the rotation is not about the Earth, it's about a point above the Earth. Some of the dissolution of the last vestiges of imperial authority at Rome in the late 5th century until the final years of the Renaissance, the Roman Catholic Church dominated the West. During the first half of this period, virtually the only schools were run by monks. Pupils had to make do with limited and second-hand sources, the teachers offering little encouragement to original inquiry or even observation. Scientific knowledge was, for the most part, regarded as little more than an aid to understanding the Bible. Saint Augustine of Hippo, once one of the largest minded of Christian thinkers, observed, now, this is a quote from him, this is an amazing quote, because this could be the principal of any school in Australia saying this. It's not necessary to probe into the nature of things, as was done by those whom the Greeks called physicists. Nor need we be in alarm the least lest the Christian should be ignorant of the force and the number of elements, the notion and order of eclipses in heavenly bodies, the form of the heavens. It is enough for Christians to believe that the only cause of all created things, whether heavenly or earthly, whether visible or invisible, is the goodness of the Creator, the one true God. Which really goes thing. Let's abandon that, kids, as long as you believe not in the Creator but in scientists and institutions. If they understand, that's good enough for you, Chappie. Okay, Professor North of Trinity College, Cambridge, a punctilious custodian of the period, adds, quote, generally speaking, Christian man saw himself as a degraded and miserable creature whose only hope was in prayer and penance, and as one to whom a rational understanding of the motions of the planets was supremely irrelevant, end quote. It's hardly surprising, then, the astrology continued to be an integral part of everyday life. Those few astronomers who had remained beginning relegated to accumulating data and improving on the precision of formulas and parameters. Astrology became the patron of astronomy, providing a market for treatises, tables, and so contributing to the survival of works that would otherwise be perished. And this is the entire thing, is that where astrology is really amateur astronomy. Gradually, however, this is what I mean, amateur, we've got different amateur astronomers. This is people outside the main process, professional. So this, you've got non-professional, and this amateur, this is just people having a shot. Now, there's a footnote here. The famous All the World's Stage speeches in As You Like It in 1599 is part of, based on an astrological reading from the man's seven ages, each so-called planets guarding a particular period of time. The sun oversees the young manhood, the years between 23 and 41. Oh, that's interesting. I'd love to read that. And it's interesting that Shakespeare is full of astronomy, with Hamlet being a review of the Danish observatories and Tycho Brahe. Gradually, however, the propagation of Christianity, centred as it was on an all-creating single deity, led the way to a scientific approach to the workings of the natural world, although the rejection of the plethora of charms, omens, dreams, and such like foolery that went to make up astrology. This, at first, hardly helped astronomy. It is true that no medieval student could get his master's degree without understanding the rudiments of how to study the heavens. On the other hand, medieval Christian universities, taking their lead from the church, never gave astronomy a prominent position. It may have been part of every introductory course, but it was taught at an elementary level, with many deficiencies to the Greek world view persisting. And I think this is what we do at the Well. We've got an elementary view. As the cultural climate warmed, oh, I love that. The first Christian universities in Europe were established in cities such as Oxford, 1069, Paris between 1050, 1096, Paris between 1150 and 1170, Bologna 1158. I remember visiting the University of Bologna. It's really interesting. The Almagest found its way into the curriculum and mathematical education both in Europe and in the Middle East, being taken as a natural sequel to Euclid's Elements and treatise on spherical astronomy by Autolycus and Theodorus. Even then, most students found it too difficult and resorted to interpretive texts that dealt with basic solar questions. Isn't that beautiful? I love those texts. With the formation of universities, there arose a figure who would come to dominate the intellectual landscape of Western Europe, the Franciscan friar Roger Bacon. Roger Bacon, the inventor of the magnifying glass. A superhero, as far as I know. 1214 to 1294. So he, the little chap, lived to 80 years old, was within his lifetime hailed as Dr. Mirabilis, the wonderful teacher, for his breadth and depth of understanding, and held for some to be the first true scientist. When Oxford was given its charter, he fought to have science made part of the curriculum, insisting that it was complementary, not antagonistic, to the faith. Now, isn't that amazing? That is an amazing thing. But you still see science as relegated as not really important in terms of curriculum here. Everywhere, he declared, there was a show of knowledge concealing fundamental ignorance. And I'm going to see if I can remember that one. But Clement the Fourth, who was Guy de Foulux, had come to know Bacon while serving as papal legate to England, now wrote to his old friend asking him to undertake a book on how the sciences should be taught. Isn't that beautiful? I'm sort of seeing this is someone who's cast out. Yeah, it's just really interesting to see how it goes. Within 18 months, Bacon had completed three large volumes in which he offered not only his ideas for better scientific method, for instance, the laboratory experience to be part of one's education, but also vehemently attack on the vices of clergy and monks. Over the next 10 years, going far beyond his commission, he would anticipate an extraordinary range of discoveries and inventions. So he would anticipate, he would actually do it. The magnetic compass needle, a method for constructing a telescope, reading glasses, the steamship, the aeroplane, workings of radiology, the cause of rainbows, the principles of camera obscura to predict pictures, even television. Well, there you go. It'd be interesting. He did actually come up with the magnifying glass. He also wrote several essays on astronomy, but Pope Clement died before he could read any of this. And his successor, Nicholas IV, condemned Bacon's writing as heretical. Gee, he was not wrong. By 1278, the wonderful teacher had been thrown into prison, most likely an unpleasant form of house arrest, which he was made to endure for the next 14 years, dying at the age of 80 and there or thereabouts in 1294. Well, I think exactly, if you do the maths. Over the next 200 years, astronomers remained preoccupied with the adaptation and manipulation of bewildering profusion of tables, and all the powers of Bacon's reasoning and universities continued to view science as a way to establish the mathematical relationship between the phenomena of nature, rather than constructing an open-minded inquiry based on empirical research and experiments. And this is exactly, you have to really understand Newton. He offers no, he was not truly scientific. He just he did experiments to guide himself, but he was uncovering the workings of God, so to speak. And I just prop the microphone a little bit. Okay. As a result, a scholar proved his prowess through the mastery of very difficult predictions, eclipses, and geometrical principles underlying the interminable tables. With one exception to all this, a revival of fascination with Aristotle. Before the 12th century, his works were largely unknown in Christian Europe, but now they came back into fashion with vengeance. And this is the great thinker was St. Thomas Aquinas. Amazing. Basically how it fused together. In particular, people often quoted On the Heavens, which proposed that science should seek out the causes of phenomena. According to Aristotle, a stone, for instance, falling towards the centre of the earth increased its speed because, being of an earthly nature, it was impatient to get home. All emotion and transition from potency to act and realisation of what may exist in any object's basic nature. This might be physics back to front, which is really basically, it is back to front. But it is interesting that back to front is such a powerful way of doing things. So a way of communicating with, like none other. Arthur it was maybe Elizabeth's front, but it won a wide following. Arthur Colster would remark that in moments when we curse the obstinate gadget or temperamental machine, we revert to Aristotle. It's amazing. Yeah. The end of the 12th century saw two main schools of thought, the strict Aristotelians and mathematical astronomers who distrusted any theory that could not be supported by elaborate tables and calculations. Bacon had helped resolve the conflict between Aristotle and Ptolemy's theories by introducing a new explanation for the ways in which various celestial spheres might interact. What is it? Question. I don't know. Let's have a lead. Full of notions of out-convex and inner-concave surfaces, his idea was no better than the predecessors, but it kept the peace. It kept both the Greek thinkers in the classical canon. Aristotle and Ptolemy continue to be taught. Their incompatibilities with each other and observable formulas were tacitly accepted. Then, in 1277, the Bishop of Paris condemned 219 propositions of Aristotle's, declaring them several of his doctrines, which such as the eternity of the world, to be heresies. The Aristotelians retreated. So, when it became mainstream, Aristotelians could actually interact with it. It came there, but it looked they had heaps and heaps of problems. Like Aristotle said, every star is an angel, and therefore they went, oh, there's only 5,000 angels out there, too few. A century later, in 1377, another Parisian cleric, Nicole Osem, wrote a commentary on Aristotle, dismissing his arguments for the immobility of Earth as purely relativistic. Although Osem, later Bishop Lisieux, could not quite persuade himself that the Earth actually did perform a daily turnaround to the axis, he at least raised the possibility that it did so. The tentative probing of the ancient assumptions about the unmoving globe was, like the Arab criticisms, one of the more, one more dint in the bodywork of the trusted vehicle, the Greek view of the heavens. He trundled happily along, its engines carefully lubricated by both the church and science. Isn't that just such a beautiful turn of phrase? You are a genius, David Cohen. I salute you. Heavenly bodies, the sun included, still moved in uniform circles, and the earth lay immobile in the centre of the rotating universe. But that was about to change. So that's the end of this chapter. You've got to understand that the circle was a religious belief. There's a religious belief in circles. So, things... Galileo believed correctly that if he had a smooth rail and you pushed it along, it would eventually go in a big circle when he got through. He did fundamental momentum experiments. Thanks a lot for listening. I'll get this all down pat.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.